This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our special episode, Separate, Black Health in America. You can find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Segregated hospitals used to be the norm. Black people were forced to go to hospitals that only treated African Americans, or some hospitals had segregated wings.
There was a colored entrance and there was an entrance for whites. There were colored waiting rooms and white waiting rooms.
But then all of that changed, and quickly. Alana Gordon brings us the story.
Brenda Armstrong grew up in Rocky Mount, a rural town in North Carolina. She remembers how black patients were treated unequally in hospitals.
They waited a longer time in the emergency room to be seen. They were addressed in demeaning ways.
Brenda is 69 now and an outspoken doctor herself. But when she was just a little girl, she had an experience that she could not shake, that would fuel her passion and her lifelong work. She was six or so, and her mom was pregnant with her baby brother. Brenda's dad was a doctor and knew her mom and the baby were in danger, that mom needed a C-section, because she was a petite woman and the baby was big. Dad reached out to the town's hospital that could handle this, but that hospital was for whites only.
My dad, he was a very proud man, and he asked, you know, if they would make an exception, and they said no.
In 1956, Brenda's baby brother, Wiley, was born, at home, without a C-section.
And I remember my dad coming to pick me up at school to tell me what had happened, and it was difficult. He could not tell me. I thought he was going to tell me that my mom had died, and she hadn't died, but my brother was in trouble, and we just didn't know what was going to happen.
Wiley had had a stroke. His left side is permanently damaged.
I was angry. I still am.
That stroke, she says, probably could have been prevented had her mother not been turned away from the nearby local hospital, the white one, for a C-section. This denial of care was standard practice back then. But by the 50s, a movement was growing to challenge the status quo, to fight back against the segregation. From restaurant sit-ins to bus boycotts, the civil rights movement was gaining momentum. And in Greensboro, North Carolina, a group of black doctors and patients set the foundation for the changes in healthcare. Gwen Blount Adolph is the daughter of one of those doctors, Alvin Blount.
I know that one of the things that just bothered my dad and his peers was that they could not treat patients in the hospital that had the better facilities.
Those facilities were for white people.
It wasn't about the better quality of the doctors, but it was about equal access to quality facilities.
When the patient of one of Alvin's colleagues needed to be hospitalized for an abscessed molar and was refused to be seen at the white hospital, they'd had enough. The group reached out to the Legal Defense Fund, a really important part of the civil rights movement. Michael Meltzner took up their complaint.
I was the one lawyer at the Legal Defense Fund who handled health cases.
What they did was challenge the federal status quo and a law that actually allowed hospitals to get federal funding even if they were for whites only. The case went through the legal ringer, but it came on the heels of the landmark Brown versus Board of Education ruling that overturned the notion that separate was equal in schools. The black doctors from Greensboro argued the same thing for publicly funded hospitals. They won. This principle that separate is unequal was then adopted into the Civil Rights Act. It clarified, plain and simple, that hospitals could not discriminate if they wanted federal money.
Which, on the face of it, should have ended the racial policies of about 6,000 Southern health facilities, hospitals, clinics, and the like.
That was the theory.
But really, almost nothing happened.
At that time, those southern hospitals didn't heavily rely on federal money. And without any major penalties, they didn't have any big motivation to change, to let black patients or doctors through their doors. Until...
No longer will older Americans be denied the healing miracle of modern medicine.
And then along came a gift, and the gift was Medicare.
No longer will illness crush.
President Lyndon Johnson signed Medicare into law on July 30th, 1965.
So that they might enjoy dignity in their later years.
This was the new healthcare program that would cover seniors, those with disabilities, millions of people the government would now generously pay hospitals to care for. This new Medicare funding had the potential to change everything, to tear down hospital segregation. But that would require more than just a rule on the books. A tiny unit took on that responsibility. It was going to be a David versus Goliath fight.
My name is Peter Labasi, Frank Peter Labasi, but everyone knows me as Peter Labasi.
Peter Labasi led that unit inside the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, or HEW.
I was then hired.
I talked to him by phone from his retirement home in Connecticut. Peter's little civil rights unit of just six people was tasked with creating and enforcing the rules that hospitals would need to follow to be eligible for these lucrative new Medicare funds.
And I'm talking about 25% of their income they were hoping to get from HEW that year.
The core rule was that no hospital would get any funding until they were completely integrated. No ifs, ands, or buts. But let black patients be treated in the same way and in the same rooms as the white patients? Early on, Peter remembers reporting the pushback to one of the higher-ups in his office.
He said, "Pete, tell me, what's up? How are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, we're doing fine, Joe." And he said, "What do you mean?" Well, I said, "You should know that there isn't a hospital in the South that's desegregated, so no one will be eligible for any of the HEW new money." He said, "Why did you say you're out of your mind?"
But the government got behind Peter's efforts. It was a game changer.
When the federal government decides to act and there's urgency about it, gosh, it's fantastic. People all around the country began to organize visitation teams.
Peter's unit, remember, was small, just six people. They needed help, and help they got. People from all over the government stepped up. Doctors from the Public Health Service, bench scientists, men and women, black and white, who wanted to see these changes in healthcare through. They were divided into teams of three, made up of someone who specialized in medicine, a government worker from the local community, and someone who knew the law. These teams went out to investigate the hospitals, in person, on the ground, to ensure that hospitals would not get any money, not a dime, until they were actually fully integrated.
This was going to require 18-hour days, threats on their lives.
David Smith is a professor who's written a book about this called The Power to Heal. He's interviewed some of those team members.
They will be chased by the Klan. Windshields will be shot out. Crosses would be burned on their lawns. And most of the people that volunteered too.
David says everybody had a story. One black doctor went in as part of a three-person team to Marshall County, Texas, to see if he could put pressure on the local hospital.
The administrator told them to go to hell, that they would never integrate. So the physician said, "Okay, but you just lost $5 million in funding for next year for your hospital." And left. 3 days later, that physician is called by the chairman of the board, who says, "We just fired the administrator. Tell us what we have to do to get the money."
Sometimes they tried to cheat, and they tried to fool us, and they tried. It was ridiculous. But the three Pepper teams said, "Wait a minute, this is not desegregation when you put one black person in a one bed up here. We mean to desegregate the whole hospital, don't you understand? The whole place has to be desegregated, or you're not going to get the money."
local constituents complained, and word got up to their congressmen. So while those teams were on the ground, Peter spent a lot of his time testifying and defending their efforts in D.C. But within a few months, they'd more or less succeeded. 98% of hospitals had integrated. In July of 1966, 1 year after Medicare passed, the program was ready to go. The money was ready to flow.
So my grandmother was one of the first people to get a Medicare card because you could apply for it in January if you had already passed your 65th birthday.
Edith Mitchell grew up in Brownsville, Tennessee. She saw this transition when her grandmother needed help.
She got admitted to the hospital. And
had she been to the hospital before?
No, that was her first time ever in a hospital.
How old was she?
She was 65.
It was a good experience. A few years later, Edith was on her way to becoming a doctor herself. She's an oncologist now, leading efforts to reduce racial disparities in cancer. And as a young med student in Virginia, she got to see the changes from the inside.
Nursing staffs were integrated so that nurses could work on any floors. Black doctors were given medical privileges so that they could admit and take care of their patients in those hospitals. It was just amazing.
She says in the years right after Medicare took effect, fewer black babies died. Health improved. Which brings us back to North Carolina, where we started this whole story.
It wasn't until I came back to Duke in the 70s to do my residency and fellowship training that I could tell a big change.
We met Brenda Armstrong at the beginning. Her baby brother had a likely preventable stroke when he was born because he was refused care at the local hospital, the whites-only hospital. Brenda has kept that experience close to her heart. She became a pediatric cardiologist and a dean at Duke's medical school.
Being dean of admissions for the medical school gave me a chance to challenge Duke to do the right thing.
When Brenda first started out decades ago, she says too many really smart and qualified African-American students got turned away. That's been changing.
Duke has done better than almost everybody in the country in the recruitment of women and students of color.
Now, black students make up nearly one-fifth of the med school. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.